Welcome to Flipping the Script. I'm Lindsay Cuiava, your host and the artistic director of Ree Theater, an online theater and education consulting company. Each week, we bring you new episodes about the theater world and theater education in an effort to revolutionize the way that theater is seen at the school and community level and inspire you to make art that matters wherever you may be. Everybody, I hope you're having a great week. I am at the International Thespians Festival in Lincoln, Nebraska, and I am having such a great time. I am exhausted. And for any teachers that are here, I am so impressed with your ability to function so highly on such little sleep. It's just been crazy and awesome getting to know all of you and meeting so many awesome young artists as well. Our booth is right by the callback table for all the colleges. And so we have been getting to meet a lot of really talented and ambitious young people. And it's just been a really great week. So this week's episode, though, is absolutely fantastic. So when I was in New York back in April, I had the opportunity to meet with Lisa Howard, who is an absolutely brilliant and amazing human. You may probably recognize her from originating the role of Rona Lisa Peretti in the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee, but she has done so much more than that. And she joins me to talk all about what it's like to create an original role, about her career, and gives amazing advice to both educators and students about this industry and going into it. And we have a fascinating conversation at the end of the episode that was kind of spontaneous about what success means and how we define success. And I think for anybody that is considering going into this professionally, whether it's an actor or a technician or what have you, I think it's really important to check out this episode and listen to that part specifically, because this industry is really hard. All of this is hard, and she gives absolutely fantastic insight. So before we get to the episode, I do just want to say we are hosting a free webinar on Monday, July 1st. It's going to be all about how to make sure that you are building your program on the four pillars of success that will help you be proactive instead of reactive in your community, and also help you have that mythical other life outside of the theater. So for any educators that are interested, you can join us on Monday, July 1st at 10 a.m. Pacific. So that's noon Central Time. I will get you the information in the show notes, and we would absolutely love to see you. All right, I hope you enjoy today's episode. Talking before we pressed record about how a lot of times on the podcast we have more like educators and more like an academic look at theater, but we have a lot of young people that listen, so I'm excited for them to like hear your perspective. And I think it's always good as an educator to hear what people are doing as well out like professionally, because then we can better prepare our students as well. So
definitely.
I'm very excited.
Me too.
Awesome. All right, so why don't we, before we jump into everything, do you want to just like give us like a rundown of like who you are and what you do? Because I think people will definitely know who you are once you jump into things.
Well, my name is Lisa Howard. I hail from Akron, Ohio, where we met at the State Thespian Conference, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I went to Firestone High School in Akron. I did not go to a performing arts school or anything, but I did ultimately end up going to the University of Cincinnati Conservatory of Music. And I got a Bachelor of Fine Arts in Musical Theater. And I moved to New York, and I have worked in many regional theaters across the country, and I have also been in 6 Broadway shows.
Amazing.
My first, my Broadway debut was in the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee.
That was your debut? Yeah, my debut as
Rona Lisa Peretti. And then I was in the original company of the revival of South Pacific at Lincoln Center.
Amazing.
And then I did another original show, which was 9 to 5, the musical on Broadway. Yeah. I got to work with Dolly Parton. That was really cool. And Allison Janney.
Yeah.
And then after that, I'm trying to think. I did get cast in the original company, but I ended up hurting my knee before rehearsals began. So I was going to be in the original company, but I ended up, but then that girl who then took over my part, she left and I got to go into the show, which was Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. I did one of the divas. We come flying in, yes. You know, from the,
yeah.
and then I did, It Should Have Been You. Mm-hmm. Directed by David Hyde Pierce, and co-stars with Tyne Daly and Harriet Harris, and and my most recent show was Escape to Margaritaville.
Yeah. And I heard about that last year. My dad and stepmom are like giant Jimmy Buffett fans, and so they were like, oh, maybe we'd go see like a Broadway show or something.
Yeah. No, well, and that's what everybody thought was going to happen, because everyone's like, I love Jimmy Buffett. Yeah. Great. We thought, awesome, built-in audience. Right. And we didn't last. They just didn't sell enough tickets in New York. The New York-based audiences were not feeling it. And it was a fun, super silly show, just what you would expect it to be.
Right.
You get a margarita, there's beach balls at the end, you laugh a lot, and it's Jimmy Buffett music. Right. What more could you ask for?
Right.
Yeah.
But are they... There's a tour. Because I feel like that would do really well in other parts of America.
Because we did a mini tour. First, we opened in La Jolla, California.
Okay.
That's where, you know, our out-of-town run was.
Sure.
It was very well received. And people loved it. Had full houses. And then we did a mini tour where we were in New Orleans. Again, loved it there, Houston and Chicago, and it did well. But when we came to New York, it just, this New York kind of tri-state area, that usually makes up the first year of a crowd.
Okay.
And then, you know, it kind of branches out, but
right.
it just didn't happen, which was quite a bummer.
Yes. Oh my gosh.
I was looking forward to sitting in that one for a long time.
Yeah. Well, did you do all the out of towns with it as well? Oh my gosh. And so
it was a long part of my life to have it last for 3 months.
That is crazy. But that's how this goes. Like, you just don't know what is going to hit and what's not.
Yeah.
And I want to come back to that. But before we do, like, so I'm always curious, like, what made you want to go into the, like, to do this as a career and then stick with it? Because I think that those wanting to go into it initially and then sticking with it mm-hmm. are two very different things, but it's so important.
Yeah. Well, I had started singing young, like to records, little record albums, as a child, and singing along with them. And, you know, in fifth grade, my music teacher had given me a solo in our Christmas pageant. You know? And someone said to my parents, maybe you should get her voice lessons. She has really a natural gift. And so I started taking voice lessons fifth and sixth grade. And then I ended up doing show choir, and it just became something that I was good at,
mm-hmm.
you know, but I also played sports and I was good academically too. And, I had taken voice with one gentleman, and then I switched to a woman named Jean Blair. And by about my junior year, and I was doing, like, you know, the state competitions and things like that,
sure.
where you get adjudicated and whatever. And she really kind of said, you know, if you want to do this, you've got to take it more seriously,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I was doing this and that and show choir and this and sports and I didn't really practice, you know, you just kind of sit back and whatever natural talent you have, you know.
Yeah.
And so she kind of lit that fire under my butt and said, so if you really want to do it, you've got to, you know, put in a little more effort.
Right.
And so I did. And I started auditioning, you know, I found out what schools, you know, had it was just something that I was
good at, mm-hmm. that I enjoyed, that I kind of knew deep down in that I could do. Mm-hmm. And so I took dance classes and I took acting classes. Finally, then after she said, kind of gave me that swift kick in the butt, so I dropped the sports and I took dance, and mm-hmm. I should have taken dance in the fifth grade when I started taking voice lessons, and my mom said, oh, do you want to take dance too? And I was like, ugh. No, like I was like, that's stupid because I was such a tomboy.
Sure.
And yeah. I was like, I'm playing softball, mom. You know, like, I was like, why? Why didn't I take dance then? Well, whatever. It's fine.
Right. It all worked out.
It all worked out. And so then I ended up getting into the CCM, which is mm-hmm. Cincinnati Conservatory, and which is a challenging school. It's a tough school to get into. There's, I don't know, we probably had 20 in our class.
Wow. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So once you keep getting that kind of encouragement in a way, you know, even though I was, you know, so green and didn't know how to act or all of that, really, right. you know, but you know, you just have that feeling that something, like, you could do this, mm-hmm. you know? And so then I went to school. And so once I kind of had my mind set on it.
Yeah.
I'm not one to give up.
That's good, though.
Uh-huh. And so even though I didn't get my first Broadway show until I was 30,
okay.
I had done a national tour and I had done well working in regional theaters and things like that. So right. it was just kind of like, yeah, nope, this is what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And you just keep at it. And there were definitely moments, you know, when I thought, what the heck am I doing? I still have those moments.
Fair.
You know, but there is something, you know, about it that you say, okay, I'm going to stick this. The good outweighs the negative.
Right.
And, you know, you just keep at it.
Yeah.
And if the keeping at it isn't working for you anymore, at some point, I think I'll maybe switch to something else. My husband would probably like it if I did. Only because it's so inconsistent. Right. Not that I haven't had great successes. Mm-hmm. I came to New York and I am literally doing what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
But it's not consistent. And so when you're having a family and paying a mortgage and all of that kind of stuff, it's frustrating.
Yeah, for sure. But I think the best advice I was ever given was that, because I went to once when it was here, mm-hmm. And Steve Kazee, I asked him, I was like, what is, like, there's one piece of advice for, like, young actors, like, what do you have? And he's like, if you can find anything else in your life that you love as much as this, do that. And he's like, I'm not trying to be cynical. And right. I was like, that is the best advice that somebody's ever given me, because I actually stopped doing theater. Well, I went to school for acting, and then I was like, ooh, that's not my thing. Dramaturgy is my thing. And then I stopped doing theater altogether to go work at Microsoft for a year. And I was like, I can't do this.
Yeah.
Like, I can't find, like, the joy that I find, even with all the inconsistency and the crazy hours and just the chaos that this all is.
Yeah.
And so I think that's really great advice. And I think that, though, is important for young people to know, is that it is chaotic.
It is. And that's one thing. So here's the difference. I'm just going to use my husband as an example because it's the most immediate for me.
Yeah.
As an actor, you know, it's like you're programmed to know that your day to day will, one, never be the same. Mm-hmm. Your year to year will never be the same. You have to be okay with going with the flow. If you are not a go with the flow type of person, forget it. I mean, literally, forget it. Mm-hmm. There is no pattern. There is no, if I do this, then this will happen.
Yep.
You have to be okay with not having any idea. Someone says, oh, what are you doing next spring? I have no idea. What am I doing next month?
Yeah.
I have no idea. But it's a little bit faith mm-hmm. that something will work out. It's a little bit of having humility in saying that, I mean, I have a day job. I have to have other ways to make money. Yeah. My show closed 6 months ago. Mm-hmm. You know, you can only save so much if your show ran 3 months.
Yeah.
You know, so, like, you have to be like, prepared to work, do other things, whether it's concerts or teaching voice lessons, or like I do clothing fittings for different companies. I just randomly stumbled into that years ago. Yeah. You know, whether you have to go back and wait tables, you have to be able to keep the roof over your head, you know, and some, you might be lucky. I know people who have, you know, maybe they're ensemble dancers or even, you know, people who get the secondary leads or whatever, and they jump from show to show and they might have a month or two off, but they also maybe don't have kids and they can go out of town. And I mean, I could be working all the time, but I can't. I can't just pack up and leave.
Right.
Now, but before I had kids, yeah, I'd be like, bye. Yeah. See ya.
Yeah.
But it's those sacrifices. It's what you're willing to take, what you're willing to sacrifice, what you are, you know, it's all about finding that balance, and it's constant. And it's constant. And no, and people would think, oh, she's a great career. Like,
yes.
Super success. You know, I've been on TV and in film and on Broadway. And yes, on paper, it's great, but it's not consistent. And so it's always that thing of what's next. Finding the next thing. And you have to be okay with that. Whereas my husband is a very, I wake up and I do this and I go to work and this, and I know how much money I'm going to make. So therefore I know how much I'm going to have when I retire. Or can I pay the bills at the end of the month? And it's, you know, which is a very perfectly logical and very, you know, valid point.
Yes.
I get it. I am just okay with a little more chaos.
Yeah.
And you have to be. Mm-hmm. And I guess the day when I'm not okay with that, I guess will be the day when I have to, you know, get a real job.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. It's like, oh no.
And I wish I could say that that goes away after you have some success, but it most definitely doesn't.
Yeah.
It's all up to what you are willing to sacrifice and do. You know, if push came to shove and we needed to keep our mortgage and it was nothing was coming down the pike, you know, would I go on a tour for 6 months? Maybe. But like, I have a kindergartner. How could I do that?
Right.
You know, so yes, there are jobs available to me. Can I take them?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's like a whole other thing that I don't think it's talked about a lot publicly, or like not publicly, but like, you know, like in the conversation, like how, like that whole like balancing a family and doing this career. And I mean, I haven't because I'm so nervous about it. Cause I'm like, how do you find that balance? And like, you just figure it out.
You play it.
Yeah. That's a really good.
You play it by ear.
Yeah.
Now, when I was able to do the La Jolla run of the Margaritaville, because I knew it has to have a payoff in the end. If it's just some like random show or, you know, whatever, I'm not just going to go out of town for 4 months.
For sure.
But it depends on the money. Mm-hmm. Depends on what your agent can negotiate you. It depends, you know, you have to ask for what you need. I brought my kids out with me for 7 weeks to California. My son finished out first grade. With a tutor in California, because I was like, if I'm going to do this job, I can't not have my kids with me.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense.
So, you know, it's like asking for what you need, and hopefully they want you enough to make it happen. And, you know, and that's the only way, really.
I mean, that's awesome though that you like have like found that balance and you're like constantly trying to, I guess. Right. Yeah. And I think that, I mean, I know a lot of my students when we're all young, we have like very like, you know, idyllic ideas of what it will be like to work in the industry. And I think that that's really interesting that you bring up, like, because you have originated a lot of roles and been some like really incredible things, but it's not always going to be consistent no matter what.
Yeah. One time, like at the stage door after It Should Have Been You, someone might not have been following or know my career since Spelling Bee. And, you know, that was a long time from, that was like a, I don't know, 10 years later, 8 years later. And someone's like, oh my gosh, what have you been up to since Spelling Bee? I'm like,
four other Broadway shows, two kids, and a movie? Like, what?
You've been doing a lot of this?
I was like, I've been doing a lot. But, you know, like, people only know the shows that they know.
Right.
I was like, I've been keeping at it. You know,
yeah,
like.
Right, yeah. That is too funny.
Yeah.
Okay, so because you have originated so many roles, I'm just, like, curious. Like, what is that like?
It's
great. Process-wise. Okay, so,
oh, yeah. It's great. You're in the room, you try something, and you say, what about this? And they say, and you are a part of that creative process, even though you didn't write it yourself. Or the next day you come in and the scene you've just done is changed. You have new dialogue, mm-hmm. and it's changed. And so then you interpret that a different way. And it's very much so a collaborative effort.
Yeah.
You know, so you really are more attached to the show than, say, coming in and replacing. You know, although
yes.
that's fun too. I have done that.
Yeah.
But it's so much better when, you know, in my opinion, only
yeah.
because I've gotten to do it quite a few times, where you are really a part of the creating, and you, maybe you're blocking and you say, how about, can I try coming in from here? Can, you know, what if I, this, you know, whatever the circumstance may be. And oftentimes, you know, the director, it's, you know, will say, sure, yeah, try that. And they might not like it. And they say, no, go back to the other door. Or
right,
whatever
right, right.
it is. But you have that power, I guess, in a way of helping really shape what it is.
Mm-hmm. That's so cool.
Because you bring yourself to whatever role it is anyways.
Yeah.
You know, because you can't help but do it.
Right.
It's just because it's you doing it. And, you know, so part of you ends
yeah.
up becoming a part of that character.
What would you say is the, like, part of you that shows up in Rona Lisa Peretti?
I don't know. In Rona. I guess that, like, kind of chipper, even though it's tense, kind of
got
thing.
It. Yeah, no, for sure. No, just curious. Yeah, because Spelling Bee, I was in a production in college of it, and I've always really thought it was such a fascinating show because it seems so easy.
Mm-hmm.
It is so hard. I am not a singer. But I was a singer in the show, obviously. But, like, those harmonies to this day still haunt me. like Pandemonium's harmonies and, what was it? Woe Is Me. Those,
yeah.
like, ones were, like, they're crazy hard. I thought they were. I mean, not singer again. But, like, but it's also, but just, like, from a skill-wise, it's a deceivingly difficult show. But also, like, from a storytelling point of view. Because, like, it's like these kids, but there's so much going on.
So much going on. Yeah.
And it's, yeah. Like, how was that to, like, unpack that show and, like, bring that to life?
Well, I did the very first workshop when it started becoming a musical. At first, it was an improv show my friends,
that makes sense.
Sarah Salzberg and Jay Reese and Dan Fogler were part of this improv group. And that was like a sketch they had come up with.
Okay.
And then Sarah Salzberg just happened to be Wendy Wasserstein's nanny, the famous author.
Yeah.
And so Wendy came to see the show. And she told her friend, William Finn, about it and said, you need to turn this into a musical.
Oh my gosh.
And so because Sarah Salzberg was Wendy Wasserstein's nanny, who was friends with Bill Finn, that's how it ended up becoming a Broadway show. So when I came in, and I knew Bill Finn because I had done many a reading down at the NYU Graduate Musical Theater Writing Program.
Okay.
They hire actors every spring to come down and do a four-day reading of the grad students' thesis projects.
That's fantastic.
And Bill is an adjunct professor there.
Okay.
So I had literally known him for years.
Yeah.
And I had heard that he was doing this project up in Barrington, at Barrington Stage, and my friend Vadim Feichner ended up being the musical director. I met him at NYU as well. And my boyfriend at the time had an audition for this new show. And I was like, what is this? I called Vadim. I was like, why am I not coming in for this? What is this? And he was like, ugh, I don't even know. Something about a spelling bee. We're going up to the Berkshires for, like, literally no money. Don't bother. And I was like, okay. And then nothing. And then I was like, okay, fine. I didn't get an appointment. And then the day that they were having the auditions,
I guess maybe Bill said, why isn't Lisa coming in? And Vadim called me. I happened to be at a friend's house. Luckily, I was in town. I was out of town doing a show. I was in town at a friend's house having a glass of wine. And I had no music or a headshot or anything. And Vadim said, can you come down to whatever, whatever, and come audition for the show? And I was like, okay. And
why?
So I just, and Carmel Dean, who ended up being the associate musical director, was in the room. And she was she happened to be playing someone's show that night, like a cabaret. So she said, I have this binder of music. Do you know anything in it? And I was like, sure. So I just picked a song from somebody else's binder. And then I sang like Somewhere Over the Rainbow a cappella or something random. And then, so that's what I sang. And then they described what they thought the, you know, character of Rona was. And they said, now just talk to us as her.
Oh my gosh.
And that is not my wheelhouse.
Yeah.
But I did what they asked. You know, in the improv world, it's all about who can be funnier. You know, and that's what they were looking for, that jokey joke kind of, you know, thing, like coming up with that kooky character right away. And I just did what they said, and it was more like kind of an honest, you know?
Yeah.
And Rachel Schenken afterwards said, no, you did exactly what they said. You just weren't jokey, you know?
Yeah.
But Bill Finn is the only reason why I was in the show, because all the improv people were like, no, she's not funny. She's not funny, no. And Bill said, I need somebody who can sing, you know, so that's the only reason that I got in the show.
Oh my gosh. And then that is crazy. Like, but you just showed you never know.
You never know.
When.
So that's how I ended up getting into the workshop.
Oh my gosh.
And then, you know, it was a handful of songs and some sketches of scenes. And Rachel Schenken wrote the book as we went along. Bill wrote songs as we went along. But even though we obviously needed polish and what you could just, I remember saying to my mom, there's something really special about this. Like it's, I think it's going to be really good.
Yeah. Well, you were right.
And that was really fast too. Cause that was in February of 2004. And then that summer we went back to Barrington and did like a small production of it in the cafetorium, you know, where it's like a cafeteria with a stage.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
It was literally a cafeteria.
Oh my gosh.
So then it was a, you know, show. And then that fall, we were at Second Stage off Broadway. And James Lapine was now our director because he had come to see us in Barrington.
Oh my gosh. And so then
James Lapine is on as our director because he and Bill, you know, go way back. But before we closed that run, they said, oh, and guess what? We're going to Broadway. You start rehearsals, you know, in, say, February. We were like, what the heck? So by May, I was on opening the Tonys. And I was like a year later, I was like on the Tonys, standing next to John Lithgow and going, what? Where am I? Somebody pinch me. And Al Sharpton was our guest speller. It was,
my gosh.
Yeah. And that was my Broadway debut.
That is a crazy Broadway debut. So fast. Like, oh my gosh.
Yeah. We're, you know, comparatively, some shows are in development for 8, 10 years.
Right.
Before they make it.
Yeah.
Before they get the funding, before they, whatever
yeah, happens. All the things. That's.
Wow.
That I did not know that. I love like the weird, like behind the scenes story. So I'm just like, this is so cool. That's really awesome. So there's in the world right now, some things going on with Spelling Bee, at a high school in the Northeast. I can't remember Maryland. I think it's in Maryland. And they just had, a production canceled, and we can just touch on this just for a few minutes. Cause I have so many other questions.
Yeah.
But, I'm just curious, like as somebody who was in this play, like it means a lot to you. Like how do you have thoughts like when high schools are trying to censor the work that like you guys have created or.
Well, for one, the reason that this certain production, the kids had been rehearsing for what, 3 months that you rehearse for in high school to put up a production of Spelling Bee, which has literally been done all over the country.
Absolutely.
And there is nothing overtly anything in this show other than the innocence of kids. And this, the one character just so happens to have two dads. It's just a fact of the show. It's nothing. There are no agendas or messages being pushed with it. It is just a fact of life because there are kids who have two dads. There are kids who have two moms. Are you going to censor them from your school? What line are you going to cross? This is a piece of art. That just happens to be the fact of that child's life. Mm-hmm. Nobody is pushing any agendas down anyone's throat. This story is about kids learning how to deal with their emotions and in a spelling bee. You know, so I want to say, get over yourselves. Get over yourselves, you know. So or do you completely shut off your television? Do you, you know, you're sending a worse message than anything that you disagree with about somebody else's choices by doing that than anything that that play could have said to your child.
I mean, that was beautifully put. I mean, I think that you touched on something with Spelling Bee in particular that I think is really interesting is it is about the innocence of children. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously in the high school edition, they changed Chip's storyline a little, which is
right.
Understandable.
Of course.
But it is like, it's so funny, that show, because they're so innocent. Uh-huh. And they also are learning how to deal with, like you said, with their
real
emotions.
Life.
And that's what this is.
Uh-huh.
And I have such an issue, people that listen to the podcast know this too, like with censorship or trying to get kids to have to like just do the Disney musical and take any of the real life out, because Spelling Bee, like there are students that would be performing it as high schoolers or middle schoolers that are dealing with anxiety or who
of
are dealing
course.
With like all the different issues that those kids
or who have two dads. Or
even though the school said that wasn't the issue, it
clearly
was.
Oh, come on.
100, right. Like, we're not stupid.
So, or was it Mitch Mahoney as the comfort counselor? What
right.
is it? Was it the unmarried person who's the Spelling Bee host? Was it, you know what I mean? What issue
yeah.
are you going to draw with? Do you literally live in a bubble?
Yeah.
It's like the most innocent show. Like,
yes.
For crying out loud.
Well, but and like people will find, I mean, I have worked on, gosh, I'm trying to think like the most ridiculous, and this is really fun because I'm going to talk about another podcast I'm recording later today, but with Mamma Mia, like people, like there was a production I worked on, I consulted on it, and people lost their minds over, well, a part of the community did, over the fact that kids were on stage swearing. And I'm like, the things that we try to keep from young people performing on the high school stage is absolutely insane
it's
to me.
Ridiculous. Have you ever been around a group of high school students for 2 minutes?
Yes.
I mean,
that's what I always say to parents. It's like,
but you're okay that she doesn't know who her dad is.
Oh,
well,
that
show.
Was also.
Do you know? Okay. You know.
Well, but like, I was like. Of all the things in this show, which I don't think Mamma Mia is a great high school show because it's a weird story. Not from like a censorship or
right.
like whatever, but it's just like,
but whatever. It's like, okay, what are you going to
right.
take issue with?
Like people, like right. I think right now.
You're going to start burning books soon.
Pretty much. That's how I feel.
Out.
I was just reading an article by Howard Sherman, who I'm interviewing later today, that said that the quote that like, the issues that we're talking about with high school kids on stage is down 20%. So drug issues down 20% since the 90s, teen suicide, like any kind of mental health stuff. And we're just doing the big name Broadway shows that we've like scrubbed clean that really don't have anything that like our kids can grasp onto. And
how many high schools have done Grease?
Oh my gosh, don't.
What a raunchy show. If you've ever watched Grease or, you know, not
actually
granted,
watched it.
No, granted, they clean it up for high school. I did it in high school. I had to make out with a kid on the bleachers in the show.
Right.
Like, you know, no. Would you have not put on Grease? I mean, like, where does the line end?
Yeah.
Would you have done Oklahoma?
There you are like seeing all of the things that I talk about all the time. This is my favorite thing. Continue.
Yeah, no, I mean, think about the issues that you have in Oklahoma.
Oh, yeah.
Think about the issues of race that you have in South Pacific. Where does the line stop? Why can't you open the world up to your students? Actually, by doing it in a show, it gives them some kind of outlet to be able and allowed to think about things of the world.
Absolutely.
Through show form, so where it's not directly happening to them, but they can see it and think about it and think how they would feel. It's a great teaching tool.
I couldn't agree with you more. And this just, I hope this is helpful for educators that are tuning into this episode, because I know that there's a lot of pressure from your administration and from those parents that just are going to find everything wrong. But really, your main focus should be your students. And finding work that like speaks to them.
I am trying to think of a show that won't call up issues and not one issue. I'm trying to think of one that is completely devoid of anything questionable. I don't think it exists. You know, someone will be able to find fault with something. So where does the line stop?
Absolutely. I mean, I had a teacher tell me that they had to cancel, like they were going to do Shrek.
Uh-huh.
And the administration at the community theater that she worked at wouldn't do it because they found the farting too lewd.
Oh, for crying out loud.
Right? Like it is. Like you can find issue with everything and I don't know.
That's a real thing. You're not making that up?
No, I'm not making that up. Like I can show, it's like I have the email. Like, wow. She was like, I don't know, like, how to, like, she was talking about it, and then now she's doing Cinderella instead. And I was like, you got to get some different people on your admin. Like, or we have to figure out how to.
So they're okay with child abuse?
Apparently.
Okay.
Now
I got you. I hear you.
Exactly. No, that's, yeah, I think that that's some really awesome insight.
Because, you know, someone could say, Cinderella is about child abuse and magic, which isn't real, and you're giving kids false hope. I mean,
people are crazy.
If I want to go down that road,
this would be fun. We could just do this for the rest of the podcast.
Literally,
on every musical.
Uh-huh.
That is so funny.
What are you teaching my children
exactly
about magic and? Giving them planting ideas in their heads.
Yeah.
Like, crazy.
People, yeah, it is a crazy world. Okay, so you brought up the South Pacific as we were just doing that last thing, which I just want to ask you some questions. I would love to hear about your experience doing it because South Pacific is my favorite Golden Age musical.
Mm.
I think it's so interesting, like the history behind it, the fact it came out 4 years after World War II even ended. And then like reading and like following the Lincoln Center production just seemed really interesting how you were able to bring that story to modern audiences and all that. So I'm just like curious, like how was that process? Was it as magical and like interesting as it seemed
from
the outside?
It was wonderful. For one, being able to work at Lincoln Center, having Bartlett Scher as the director, they tried to really make everything authentic.
Yeah.
You know, the costumes were great. They had the original 40-piece orchestra. And so when had our Sitz Probe and we had all those musicians in and we're all sitting around and we hear that opening, on the strings, we all were just crying because it was so glorious. And what they did in our show is that they built the stage so that the orchestra is underneath. And when the overture started, the stage would pull back so that the whole orchestra was exposed and they could watch. It's a very long overture, too.
Oh, yeah.
And so that was a part of the show.
That's beautiful.
It was gorgeous.
Oh, my gosh.
And sometimes I would, at the top of the show, just go stand in the VOM. That was one of those theaters and just listen, you know. So that was pretty great. And here's a funny story about that show. So I was cast as head nurse.
Okay.
You know, it was like an ensemble part, but I just thought that that was my role, that was it. Great. Fine by me, you know?
Yeah.
And like 2 weeks into rehearsal, stage manager comes up to me and says, so we just wanted to let you know that you're also covering Bloody Mary. And I literally laughed in his face. I was like, good one. And he's like looking at me like, no, I'm serious. And I was like, yeah, right. Are you kidding me?
And I called my agent. I was like, what? I was like, what? I'm covering Bloody Mary? How is that possible? And they said, they looked at my contract and it was, you know, head nurse and as cast. So that means they can throw anything in there that they want, and they needed a second cover. Now, obviously, I would not be a first cover. There were other, you know, people of Asian descent in the company who was the first cover. But I had to learn the whole role. I had to go to understudy rehearsals.
Oh, my gosh.
And I was like, I am going to offend someone by playing this role.
Yeah.
Okay. I was like, I am the whitest of white girls with freckles. And, like, I was not that I couldn't pull it off acting-wise.
Right.
But I was real glad that I never had to go on.
Because
I got cast. I auditioned for 9 to 5. And so I... including rehearsals and performances. I was only in the show, like South Pacific, for 6 months, which was,
okay.
And then I moved on to 9 to 5.
Wow, very different show.
Very different show. But I was kind of, I mean, I loved doing the show, but I was really nervous about having to go on for Bloody Mary.
Yeah, I wonder if they could even do that in 2019.
Like,
if
I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just a fact of we only have so many people,
mm-hmm.
and we needed someone else to cover in case our two people of Asian descent, actually the woman who played Bloody Mary, she was from Hawaii.
Okay.
You know,
yeah.
So she was the closest.
Right.
And then, you know, we had at least someone else who was from whose heritage was from that side of the world.
Right,
you know?
Right. Which is important to the story.
You know.
Yeah.
But, you know, sometimes in shows, especially when they're long running, you have to have multiple covers. You just do.
Yeah.
Because people are out, people have sick days, people have family things, people,
nice.
You know, and so, I mean, I get it. I just didn't want to play the part.
No, I mean, it totally makes sense.
Yeah. So I was like, I got 9 to 5 and I was like, all right, Imani, bye.
That's crazy. And how long were you with 9 to 5?
Well, I did the out of town run in Los Angeles.
Okay.
So that was in the fall, like August. So that was like several months. We rehearsed in New York and then took it out to the Amundsen in LA. And then come the winter that following year, we, you know, opened, but we really, you know, like say you're a spring show, maybe you open in March, you know, but we only lasted through, say, the summer.
Mm-hmm.
We closed at like the end of the summer, which happens to a lot of shows. That's what I was hoping at least would happen with Jimmy Buffett. We closed in July.
Oh,
I was like,
we are a bummer.
I was like, we're a summer show that can't even play through the summer.
Oh.
I was like, that's horrible. So, but 9 to 5 played, I think, like up to September, like all the way through the summer of that year. So, you know,
yeah,
I did it for counting the out of town runs for like a year.
Okay.
You know,
yeah.
With the out of town and the rehearsing and all that.
Yeah. I really like that show.
It's fun.
I mean, it's such a fun show and I love the music. I mean, it's not like...
That was another show that we all thought that would last longer. But sometimes it doesn't even have to do with the show too. It's what house you're in.
Mm-hmm.
That was another show that was in the marquee. That the Marriott Marquis is a big theater to fill.
Yeah.
It's expensive to rent. You know, I know, like, we had gone over budget on the sets and the lighting and, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
it was just a big show that was not recouping fast enough.
Yeah.
And I think they just pulled the plug.
Right.
I mean, I get it. It's not my money invested in it.
Yeah.
But it is my livelihood.
Yeah.
A weekly paycheck.
Dang.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's such a hard... You can be like, this logically makes sense, but seriously?
Yeah.
Stop.
I know.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that's crazy. And I also think that, like, I mean, 9 to 5 has such commercial success now, like in the community theater, even in the high school theater world. I think a lot of people sometimes, it's really funny when I talk to people and they tell me, they're like, oh, well, this is like a show that was like super successful on Broadway or like super, like, we have to do a big name Broadway show. And I'm like, a lot of the shows that are really popular in that part of the world, don't actually do well on Broadway.
Yeah.
And that's fine. So, like, stop putting all your eggs in the, like, does it have Broadway recognition basket? Like, Seussical, one of the most performed shows, terrible on Broadway.
It didn't even do well.
No. Like,
no.
So, and then that's really interesting. With 9 to 5 in particular, it's a really great script and... Yeah. And it should have
rained. It's a good show.
Yeah, it's a good, it's solid. It's got, yeah, yeah, everything no, totally. There.
But like, yeah.
Yeah.
And it should have been you has been doing it. It didn't run very long either.
Yeah.
But it's been being done all over the place.
Right. Because it's so interesting.
The thing is, the way it was a hard show to market.
Mm.
Because you don't want to give away the plot twist.
Right.
And so people are like, a show about a wedding? You know, like that's right. Why you're like, oh, but I know Neverland, Finding Neverland, that has to be about Peter Pan. I'll go see that because I'm familiar with it. Or, you know, I mean, because you are competing with whatever else is running.
So true.
With you, you know, mm-hmm. So, but everyone who went to see It Should Have Been You loved it. Like the audiences were howling with laughter. They loved it. And it was just, they didn't, you know, they just couldn't fill the house because it was a hard show to market.
Yeah.
You know, so, and you would have thought with Ty Daly, Harriet Harris, Chip Zion, Sierra Boggess, like it wasn't for lack of names in the show. It wasn't for, the music was great. The script was hilarious. You know, you had some weighty names in the show, you know. I don't know. You just never know.
Yeah. No, that's, and again, back to all that like chaos and you just, it's always finding that balance. And so just to switch gears just a little bit, because you've also, we're in this like show called Twilight that people might know. It had some like minor success in the world.
Yeah.
When I was like reading your bio, I was like, oh my gosh, I have seen you in that show more times than I should ever admit. Because I shouldn't have loved Twilight as much, but it was just always like, it's a good, fun.
I read all the books before I had gotten the audition.
Yeah.
And I was like, I have an audition for Twilight. This is hilarious. Because I was doing 9 to 5 when I had gotten the whole series, and I was reading the books during when I was doing 9 to 5. I would go to my gondola, get dressed, and go stand at the makeup mirror in the light to read Twilight, and then put it down and go into my entrance. So I really loved the books.
Well, they're like so addicting. I read them all in 4 days.
That's like, what I'm saying. You're obsessed.
Yeah, but then you also end it and you're like, wow, why?
Yeah. So I got the audition and I had just signed on with a new manager. And so this was great. I put myself on tape. She had a casting director friend. So I just went to the office and they put it on tape for me there.
Yeah.
And one of their people just read with me. We probably recorded it twice. And like a week later, I got a call that I had gotten the part.
Dang. Like, that's crazy.
It's crazy. I was like, huh. Wow, what? You know?
Yeah.
Because, you know, I just kind of had fit the description of the character.
Totally.
And that, I don't know.
And they you were did. Like,
that's it.
Yeah. That's awesome. So, because that was like, obviously, like, big, major blockbuster hit in the world. And you also have been, though, in like big, successful shows on Broadway. And I'm just curious, because my students are always talking about like, I want to be a film actor and a stage actor and all that. And I'm like, I don't know as much about the Hollywood side, but I can help you on the other. What is the difference between like being in like a huge success on Broadway versus like in Hollywood?
Well, obviously I have more experience in the Broadway world.
Yeah.
And I'm just now more so getting into doing a little bit more TV and film. So I was very glad when, even though my character in the Twilight book had more to do and say, that there were so many people that they were bringing in the movie, you have to pick and choose something, a more tangible talents. Like mine was like being able to will a situation to go the way you want it to go. Like that's not an actionable thing to do. So I just stood around a lot and looked like a vampire, you know, like, so I was grateful though, because I had never been on a big movie set like that. I was like, I don't want that pressure. So it was great to be present, but not have a lot of the weight on my shoulders.
Got it.
Which was great.
Yeah, you know? For sure.
So that was helpful. And it was one of those experiences that, you know, I'll never forget. We filmed in Baton Rouge for
crazy
a couple of months.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
And I was like, all right, this is it. But you're using the same skills,
yeah,
the same acting skills and hitting your mark and, you know, being able to, okay, when they say action, you're present in the moment of the scene, all of that kind of,
yeah,
stuff. It's using your same skills. It's just different and it's repetitive in a different way. So when you're doing a Broadway show 8 times a week, you start from the beginning of the show and you go to the end of the show, mm-hmm, and you work through all of those emotions in the order, in the same order. Every night you recreate that live experience.
Yeah.
Okay. When you're filming something, you're jumping all over the place in the story.
Right.
It just depends on location and what they get when and who, you know. So, mm-hmm, like, you could be filming a scene that's halfway through the movie the first day. Or, you know, so it's kind of doing your homework beforehand and knowing where you are emotionally at the top of that scene and where you're going, you know. Like,
right,
it's really scene by scene. Whereas in theater, you get the arc of the story.
Yeah.
You have the arc of the story. When you're filming, it's just literally moment, tiny moment by tiny moment.
Yeah.
And so it's the same skills. You just, you know, are repeating it in that one little moment for however long until the take is shot.
Yeah.
So, like, I just did an episode of The Good Fight,
okay,
a CBS show. And I played a witness in a courtroom, mm-hmm, scene. And I was, I'm part of this lawsuit. My husband had died and we were suing the insurance company because they were denying him coverage. Say it was a pre-existing condition. Anyway, so I had this courtroom scene and the lawyer ended up making my character cry because he was trying to gild the lily, you know, and really pushing the case. And so he, like, purposely did it, made me think about my husband and talk about our honeymoon and all that. He put on a hat my husband wore. Anyways, so in the scene, I had to end up sobbing in his arms. Now, that's fine. You rehearse it. You get up the mojo. You get it. You know, you've got the tears. Great. You think, oh, that's great. I'm just going to have to do that once. No. When you're shooting a TV episode, you know, you shoot it from this angle and this angle and this angle and this angle and this angle. Now, they'll let you know when the camera is directly on you or to your side. And, you know, so this time maybe you don't have to have real tears, but it has to all look the same and sound the same. But
crazy,
you know, so, like, by the end of shooting that, I was exhausted because I kept having to repeat that same emotion.
Yeah.
Over and over again. And then they would have to come back up and touch my makeup because when you cry, you look a mess and literally, you know, like, you have tears and then your eyes are all bloodshot. And then they would have to touch up my makeup. And then I'd have to do the scene again,
mm-hmm,
and do it all over again. I can't even tell you how many times.
Yeah.
You know,
that's
so, like,
crazy.
That's crazy.
Like, how do you, like, get yourself, like, I'd imagine, like, having to, like, do it so many times, like, you'd work yourself up into, like, an emotional state.
Right.
Like, how do you get yourself out of that?
Like, by the end of that day, I had a headache and I was exhausted.
Okay. So your body just kind of,
I was like,
done.
Oh, toast.
Yeah.
But once it's on film, it's done. Whereas a Broadway show, imagine if you played, say, Dear Evan Hansen.
Oh, I can't even
imagine the physical toll it would put on you to put yourself through that every night. That's why I like comedies.
Yeah.
It's
a lot less work.
It is a lot.
Like, emotional.
Yes,
like,
because
labor and
as much as it's acting, you are calling up real emotions. Because if you don't, then it's just, you're watching BS on the stage and everyone can see through it.
Oh, yeah.
And so no matter what it is, you know, it has to come from some real place.
Yeah.
Like, when I was in that courtroom, I wasn't thinking about my dead husband because I don't have a dead husband, but I could think of something that makes me cry.
Yeah.
And then that's what gets you going.
Right.
You know, it's all that acting training. So
yeah,
you're using the same skills that you would use, that you've trained with.
Yeah.
Whether it's in a Broadway show or whether it's in that scene that you have to repeat for 17 times for
right
in 2 hours, you know, but so it is the same skills, just used in a very different way.
Yeah.
One is moment by moment, like itty bitty moment by moment. And one is the whole arc of the show. You know, so you've got to start somewhere, you grow, you go down, you go up, and it's a one cohesive piece.
Yeah. Is it, oh my gosh, okay, one last question about that, and then we'll should wrap up.
Oh, really? Already?
Oh, I know. Isn't it gone so fast?
Yes.
It's crazy. So just, because I'm a structure nerd, like, because in the show, you get to, like, trace that arc.
Yeah.
And you go through it every night. How, is that difficult? Like, how do you do it in film? Like, how do you get yourself to, like, the point where you are structurally, like, and how do you, like, go there without having gone through the full journey?
Practice.
Okay, yeah.
Just being able to pick it up, having done the mental work beforehand.
Yeah.
You know, like, I shot this indie film called Decay once, where I was this crazy mother and who literally ends up lighting herself on fire.
Oh my gosh.
Like, she's a nut job. And before that scene, you know, they're setting up and they're setting up. Like, how do you gear up for that?
Right.
Crazy.
Yeah.
You know, so you just, it's part, you're playing, you're acting. So, like, I don't know, there's nothing in my life to draw on from that.
No.
But you have to think, okay, well, when have you felt that, you know, out of control emotion? You wouldn't have taken those steps.
Right.
But, you know, and you just kind of go there. And then sometimes you just have to do it.
Okay.
You know, like, you just have to do it. And,
yeah.
And it, go for it.
Oh, my gosh.
Because how do you prepare for that?
Right. I've always thought that was so interesting about film, that it's just shot non-linearly and that you just have to, like, look at, like, where you are on the character journey.
So think about that. Imagine you're in a scene study class. You've got that scene.
Okay.
So, okay, you do your homework, you do your background. Where am I at the beginning of this scene? It's just a matter of thinking about where you are in the arc of the show. You've done just a scene.
Yeah.
And it's been great. Right? So same thing.
Also, I think scene work is really important. I'm trying to get more of my students to realize, like, it's not just enough to, like, you know, like, do theater, like, just in a random, like, do a monologue or whatever. And, like, scene work and actually scene study and constantly working on that craft is really important. And now I see even more about, like, why it would be important from, like, a film standpoint.
Oh, totally. Because you have to be able to pick up at where are you emotionally, physically, everything at the top of that scene.
It's so
interesting. And then where does it go? Just in that small moment.
Yeah.
But where's the arc of that scene?
Right. Oh, sorry. Just, like, it's, like, so exciting. I, like, love, like, talking, like, oh my gosh, this and then this.
Yeah.
And this. I love all the layers and the structure. It's so exciting. I feel like we have so many more things that we could talk about. This has been awesome, but I want to make sure that you get to rehearsal.
Oh, yeah. What time is it?
It's 22.
Oh, okay.
So we have a little bit of time. So I wanted to, like, ask one last question.
Okay.
So if you could give advice to any, like, aspiring actor out there, or even somebody who's in the industry and it's just, it hasn't been their time just yet.
Uh-huh.
Like, what advice do you have?
I would say, obviously, you're doing it because you love to do it. Really check what your motivation is for being in theater.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and for doing that. If it's just for the accolades, rethink that.
Mm-hmm.
And then try not to have expectations of where you should be when, you know, because there is no timeline.
Mm-hmm.
There is no, you know, your whole career might be spent in regional theater. That's fine. Are you still doing it? Do you still love it? You know, there's always goals to strive for, but literally there are no guarantees. So do it because you love it and you love the work and all of that, because now you might go on to fantastic and great success and you might get to do all these things.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't, it doesn't diminish the work that you've done.
Yeah.
You know, so do it because you love it. And again, like we said at the beginning of the podcast, it's a matter of keeping at it and continue to study. Because you want to continue, you want to grow. You don't want to rely on the same old skills that you had back in the, you know, never change anything.
Yeah.
So continue to take class and to take lessons when you can afford it.
Yep.
And you know, if someone asks you to do a reading, do it, because it's another chance for you to learn and to, you know, learn how to make choices.
Yeah.
And step out of yourself.
Yeah.
Out of your comfort zone. All of those things. You just keep at it.
I love that. Okay, I actually lied. Can I ask one last question?
Yes,
okay. I think that, because you talked about, like, why you do theater. I mean, I talk about that all the time. Like, you can't do it for the applause. And I try to get, like, my students all the time to, like, be like, we're not doing this, like, for applause, because that's very superficial. But so I would love, this is really the last question. How do you define success in this industry? Like, in your...
how do I define success? That you are doing what you love to do, or striving towards that, because you're still successful if you're still putting yourself out there.
Right.
You know, it's a hard one to measure, but really think about it in any career. What is success? You know, is it the amount of money you have? Because I know a lot of miserable rich people.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so finding, I think, the balance of, you know, what is happiness for you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like if you love to go hiking and in addition to doing theater, finding that time to get out of the city and go and do it.
Mm-hmm.
And still being able to come back and go to that audition. And do it. That's success. That's pretty successful. Now, granted, are you, you know, like, obviously you're going to feel more successful if you've gotten that job that you auditioned for and you're doing your summer stock and,
right.
You know, it's a hard one, because if anyone looked at my career, they would say, oh, you've been successful. Yeah. You know, but do I still struggle? Yeah. You know, so again, like, how do you define that? Like, if I only defined it on my bank account and consistency of work, then I would be like, I'm not gonna, it sucks. You know, da, da, da. Like, I'm not a millionaire, you know?
Right.
So it's a matter of really your definition of what, are you happy? Are you comfortable? Are you living? Is there a roof over your head? Do you have family and friends and all of that, and are you still enjoying doing theater? Then yes, then you're successful.
I love that. I think that is beautiful. And I mean, you've said so many awesome things today, and this has been such an insightful podcast, and I so appreciate your time to do this.
I love doing this. I know, I was surprised when the time was already up.
I know. I love podcasting. It's really fun. So people want to follow you or like learn more about your work. How is there any way that they can do that?
Yeah, I have a Facebook page, Lisa Howard.
Okay.
I'm on Twitter, Lisa Howard NYC. I'm on Instagram, Lisa Howard NYC. And I also have a website, which is lisahowardnyc.com.
Awesome.
So I've tried
Lisa
to keep
Howard
it.
Lisa Howard NYC, we got it.
Yeah. I've tried to keep it consistent.
Got it on brand. Awesome. Yeah. No, and I mean, obviously then you can check out the cast albums that you are in,
yeah,
and all that. But if you want to know more about Lisa, like, we'll also have her bio in the show notes. So you can click on the show notes and we'll have links to all the different ways that you can follow her work and all that. But thank you so much. This has been super delightful. And we will be back next week with another episode. All right. Bye. Episode. If you enjoyed it, I would love if you would leave us a review or rate us on iTunes or Stitcher, or share us with your friends on social media so that we are able to help spread the word around Flipping the Script and inspire people to make art that matters across the world. As a thank you for taking the time to review us and share us, each month I'm going to be giving away a theater swag gift basket. All that you need to do in order to win is just share us and review us, and every month I'm going to select a review or a share at random, read it on the air, and if it's yours, you will be the lucky winner of this awesome theater swag bag, which is going to have so much stuff in it that's like essential for the theater nerd, no matter if you're a teacher or student or just an enthusiast. If you want to find out more about Reef Theater and our programs, our online classes, and our community for educators, just go to www.reeftheaterco.com. Theater is spelled with an R-E. Or you can follow us on Facebook at Reef Theater.
If you want to know about the work that I'm up to and find out more about ReTheater, you can follow me on Instagram. I'm there all the time giving out lots of tips and ideas and just sharing about how awesome theater education is. You can follow me at @Lindsay_CuiavaBar. If you have any questions about today's episode or thoughts you'd like to share with us, or maybe you have some topics you'd like to see us cover in the future, I would totally love to hear from you. You can send me an email anytime at lindsay@retheaterco.com. Just make sure you spell Lindsay, A-Y, and I look forward to hearing from you. As always, thanks for listening and keep on making art that matters.